going to claim the land. So I claim this room in this building on this land in the name of the Algonquin Confederacy. Only truth shall be spoken in this room. And remember, the truth comes before reconciliation, and reconciliation is an Aboriginal way. We believe in reconciliation, we believe in forgiveness, but we also believe in accountability and responsibility. Thank you for coming.
Okay, I guess I'm going to kick things off. And I have to tell you, it's very intimidating giving a paper with Dorothy here today, because I know really that you came here to hear Dorothy, not me, the sociologist. But I am so very fortunate to have had the opportunity to work with Dorothy over the last year or so. And we argued, in fact, who was going to go first here today. Guess who won? My logic was that you could hear Dorothy, then you wouldn't be stuck listening to me. You could leave the room. But it actually works to my advantage to go first, because she really would be a difficult act to follow. And also, we're saving the best for last. I do want to say as well that it's such a pleasure to be here with this crowd, with all of you here. The energy is so positive. And for other reasons as well, I live and teach in England now, and my students, in their student evaluation sheets, some of the comments are weird accent. So I'm likely not going to get that from you here today, or maybe I will. Got a bit of a strange transatlantic accent, yeah. And I also wanted to say that I gave a paper at a medical sociology conference in England last week as well. And I gave a paper pretty much about what I'm going to talk today, perhaps some less detail, about human experimentation. And at the end of it, a very highly ranked male academic, stood up and said, in a pompous manner, "Yes, but what is all the sociological relevance of this?" And my immediate reaction was to say, duh, isn't it, quite obvious? But then I began to think, well, maybe it's the sociology that isn't relevant here. And some days, I still think that, especially when I read some of the texts, which are quite impenetrable, and when I read some of the language, which is quite confusing. But actually, I think that sociology is relevant to the issue of human experimentation, and I hope to show you that here this morning. Because to me, sociology is about making the connection between the individual and society, between private troubles and public issues. And this is known as the sociological imagination. And I think it can be quite political as well. For example, Dorothy has, at great expense to her own well-being, shared her life story with me and with countless others. She's continued to fight the denials and the resistance of the Correctional Service of Canada. She's also carried out extensive research in the archives. She's spoken with other victims and other researchers, and has read, as you can see, piles and piles of material. In the process, she has exposed a history that has remained hidden. And this shows, and what she has done is show that she was not alone when she was subjected to prison experimentation. Rather, there is a whole legacy of prison experimentation, and it continues today. Furthermore, because Dorothy had the courage to go through with her lawsuit, and still is, she has made it possible for others to do so as well, to come forward, and there are different legal actions in the process at the moment. Perhaps most importantly, others have been able to draw strength, courage, and hope from Dorothy. As Jane Doe II, one of the women involved in a pending class action suit, stated during an interview with me, "I can remember being absolutely alone and wanting to stay alone and always being alone. I'm still alone. I think we were guinea pigs. I know we were guinea pigs. But some of us are still alive, And maybe we're not as afraid now to make a squeak or make a squawk. I'm getting stronger in knowing that there's other people out there like me." And Dorothy's sure squeaking and squawking in her case. So what I want to do here today is to firstly give you some indication as to how extensive prison experimentation is in Canada. And Dorothy will provide a lot more detail here. And I will leave her to tell you her own story. then I'm going to consider some facets of the prison environment which nourishes these abuses, which in fact lay the groundwork for the eventuality of prison experimentation. And finally, I will close by discussing some key moments in history which turn the eventuality of prison experimentation into a reality. Dorothy was one of hundreds of prisoners to be subjected to experimentation. Although CSC originally claimed that they could find little evidence of prison experimentation when Dorothy came forward, they eventually, if very reluctantly, disclosed thousands of documents proving the existence of prison experimentation. And Dorothy has uncovered others since. Other reporters like Mike Blanchfield and Jim Brunskill from the Ottawa Citizen have discovered others, and I too. We keep finding more and more documents. They're sort of scattered in different places, and it's kind of like a jigsaw. You piece them together, but the evidence is clearly there. For at least half a century then, hundreds of prisoners have been experimented on. And some of these experiments were designed to discover the cause of and the cure for crime. On the overhead here, which I'm sorry, we moved it forward to fit more people in, this is just an example of some of these. And it's by no way extensive. There are others, many others, but it just gives you some indication of the kinds of things they were doing to, you know, find the cause and cure of crime. I want to say as well, the experiments, you know, were undertaken for so-called therapeutic purposes as well. That is, they were claimed to be for the benefit of prisoners' own good. And as well, it was claimed to be based on the best scientific knowledge at hand. You know, it was said to be scientifically valid, reliable, and so on. And I apologize for those of you who heard me speak about some of this yesterday. It's going to be a bit repetitive. But one of the earliest, a 1950 study entitled Chromosomal Aberrations in Criminal Behavior, involved taking skin biopsies from suspected gay men and lesbians. Another study examined the association between height, chromosomal abnormality, and criminality by measuring prisoners and taking blood samples and fingerprints from them. Researchers at Queen's University hypothesized that drug addicts and psychopaths had a lower tolerance to pain. To test this assumption, female narcotic addicts were given the cold presser test, whereby their hands were placed in a tank of cold water on a bed of sharp tacks through which painful shocks were shot through. Psychopaths were simply hooked up to a constant current stimulator where shocks of increasing intensity were administered. In order to test how male psychopaths coped with threat, 41 prisoners were given headphones through which they either heard a nightclub comedian buzzing or a loud bang in their ear. Plastic surgery was offered to prisoners as a means of curing their criminality and integration afterward. However, most commonest curatives were drugs, and Dorothy's going to talk about many of these and her own experiences with LSD and others. But I want to mention another example that happened at Oak Ridge Institution and which also is at the center of current legal case. From the mid-1960s until 1982, Elliot Baker, a psychiatrist, led a number of experiments designed to reconstruct personalities of the criminally insane, so-called criminally insane. His project in social engineering was designed to force prisoners into abandoning their so-called psychological defenses through a combination of sensory deprivation, drugs, force, restraint, and humiliation. Furthermore, prisoners served as therapists for one another, deciding when their patients, other inmates, should be disciplined, medicated, and released. Some men were placed naked into the capsule, an 8-by-10-foot room. The only available food was liquid, deposited through straws protruding from a wall. The men slept on a small rug, naked. There was only one open toilet and no towels. The room was continuously lit and soundproofed. In order to prevent the likelihood of withdrawal through sleep or fatigue, the men were given a variety of hallucinogens. They were under constant observation by other inmates and staff through a one-way mirror on the ceiling or through closed-circuit camera. Often the stay was indeterminate and terminated only on the decision of the outside observers. One of Barker's publications describing the experiment was aptly titled The 100-Day Hate-In. A couple of years after Dorothy filed her legal suit, a class action suit was brought forward by subjects of these experiments. In a number of prisons, shock and antabuse were used as aversive treatments to rid prisoners of their drug, alcohol, or cigarette addictions. And a variety of token economies and operant conditioning operated across a number of prisons as well. And perhaps the most well-known of these are those that occurred at Grandview Training School for Girls. Some of you might be familiar with the recent controversy surrounding Grandview, as it has become the center of recent scandal. A 1976 investigation into abuses contributed to the school's closure. However, the subsequent report was never released. More recently, 8 former employees, including Ross, Robert Ross, who was a psychologist who developed the Foundation for Cognitive Skills Training, he was accused of physical, sexual, and psychological abuse against former inmates. While Ross has been acquitted on some of the charges and others were withdrawn, 11 remained stayed. 2 guards were, however, convicted. In November 1999, the Ontario government issued a formal apology as part of a compensation package to former inmates. And I said earlier, I think it's important to point out that Ross's work at Grandview, particularly his study on slashing or self-mutilation and co-optation, were the inspiration for his reasoning and rehabilitation program, later turned into the Living Skills or Cognitive Skills Program. In fact, the cognitive behavioral model underpinning these programs has been adopted by CSC as the framework for all current programming. And while the model has been widely praised and more recently adopted by Britain and other European countries, very few people know of its origins in Robert Ross's work at Grandview. It was also believed at the time that prisoners could be treated by contributing something back to society. At least this was the official justification for correctional involvement in drug tests carried out by pharmaceutical companies. And there were many of these as well, but I'm only putting a few on the overhead here. Sorry. No, because we've moved the overhead closer to give people room in the room. I don't think that you can you know? You lose the focus? Sorry. No. It's right at the back. But I think it just gives, just seeing, you know, the numbers there, gives you a sense, and I'll illustrate some of them. I'll go over some of them as well. And again, I want to say this isn't a complete list, but it does show that not only were prisoners used to test vitamins, aspirins, antibiotics, and enema packs, they ingested food additives and pesticides. Inmates at Stony Mountain Penitentiary, for example, were injected with blood and anti-D-gamma globulin in an effort to discover serum for mothers with Rh-negative blood. And finally, experiments have been undertaken in order to find ways of managing prisoners. There is a long history of solitary confinement, sensory deprivation, experimentation within Canadian prisons. Canada is said to be leading, you know, in this area, in fact. This just gives you, again, some of them that have occurred. And even as recently, and this is what is really scary and needs, you know, to be known, is that in January of this year, the results of a new study entitled The Psychological Effects of 60 Days in Administrative Segregation were published. The report is available online, the extensive report, but it was also published in the Canadian Journal of Criminology in January of this year. Participants included inmates who volunteered to be placed in segregation, as well as a number who were involuntarily placed in segregation. Among these were prisoners with psychiatric conditions and those who feared for their lives. You know, the question of coercion is very real in all of these experiments, including this one. And it's a stark reminder that prison experimentation is not a thing of the past. Yet, memory is short. As I stated earlier, Dorothy is to be credited for bringing all this prison experimentation to the public eye. Until her case and her work, very little was known about it. For example, until very recently, Canadian discussions around prison experimentation kept using American examples, either because they did not believe that it occurred here, or because it was thought that while there was a strong possibility it could have occurred here, there were no examples to support such a claim. As recently as 1995, an official American report on human radiation experiments concluded that prison experimentation seemed to be unique to the United States. And many have been shocked to find out that they occurred in Canada, because Canada is supposed to be the kind of place where these things just don't occur. This ignorance about Canadian experiments and the silence surrounding them was in place, despite the fact that a number of experiments were reported in scientific journals, in annual reports of the prisons and penitentiaries, in correctional newsletters and newspapers. And some of them, like the Oak Ridge experiments, were in fact subjects of TV documentaries. This reminds me of a popular quote, and one I used again yesterday, kind of keep repeating myself, but the same issues keep arising. Progress, far from consisting of change, depends on retentiveness. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So reclaiming the history of Canadian prison experimentation has been very, very important. Like sexual abuse, we first had to name it, to recognize it, before we could actually address it. The idea of prison experimentation goes back a long way. In Canada, for example, there was the prison inspector in 1879. In his annual report, wrote, "The prisoner, bereft of the rights of ordinary citizens, is surrendered body and soul to be experimented upon." In fact, prisons are about denying human rights to those it contains. They strip prisoners not only of their rights, but of their identities and their humanity. In stripping prisoners of their rights as undeserving of protection, they become dehumanized. And this process makes them vulnerable to experimentation as well as to many other kinds of abuses. The process is exaggerated when prisoners are somehow seen as different from people on the outside. As countless wars have illustrated, atrocities are much easier to commit if victims are stripped of their dignity and their differences become exaggerated or invented. And lest we think this is a thing of the past, here is a quote attributed to Lucy McClung, boasting about the success of cognitive skills training. McClung says, she's current commissioner of corrections, says, "The criminal mind does not operate like yours and mine. What would work for you in terms of deterrence will not work for offenders." The stripping away of identity, the extreme power differences, and the emphasis upon otherness is further exacerbated by an intrinsic obedience to authority expected from prisoners and from lower-ranking correctional officers. This makes it less likely that correctional researchers and employees will call one another to account if they suspect wrongdoing, or those within the institution. In essence, I think it prevents whistleblowing. Given these things, it is perhaps unsurprising then that prison experimentation occurs. And I want to emphasize that these things are built into the very idea of prisons. Prisons are about punishment, power, coercion, and control, no matter how you dress them up or down. Thus, as long as there are prisons, there will remain abuse. And I want to just end with mentioning some key historical moments which contributed to the development of human experimentation in Canada. Some historians argue that prison experimentation in fact goes back 3,000 years with condemned prisoners. However, such experimentation has remained rather sporadic until discoveries were made in the medical sciences in the late 19th century. The new disciplines of pharmacology, bacteriology, and immunology stimulated the creation of new drugs and thus new opportunities and demands for human experimentation. However, the first widespread use of human subjects in medical research occurred during World War I and intensified during World War II. War was used to justify experimentation on different grounds. For example, it was argued that new drugs had to be developed to provide soldiers with immunity to disease in the lands they were going to fight, to combat pellagra and malaria. Experiments needed to be undertaken to improve flight conditions, for example, it was argued, for pilots, or sea conditions for Navy personnel. And psychiatrists were brought in to cure so-called shell shock. Perhaps the most well-known wartime experiments...
Sorry.
That's okay. Dorothy, do you want some?
Thanks.
Go on. Were those undertaken by the Nazis. As many know, the Nuremberg Code, designed to protect human subjects in medical research, was establishing following the revelation of Nazi experimentation. What is less known, however, is that during the Nuremberg trials, one of the witnesses pointed out that the Americans had been carrying out wartime experiments on their own prisoners, malaria and pellagra experimentation. The question was, who, therefore, were they to talk and to be passing judgment on other people? Well, George Ivy, a medical researcher from one of the Ivy League universities, took it upon himself to address this charge. He essentially wrote up a report, the Green Report, and created a puppet committee to approve it. And despite evidence to the contrary, the report concluded that the American prison experiments were paragons of ethical design and research. The report helped to inform the Nuremberg Code, but it also began a legacy whereby North American researchers felt that the code did not apply to themselves, and in particular, it gave the all clear to prison experimentation. The Cold War, and more specifically the Korean War, of course, were used to justify numerous mind control experiments. It was thought that the Russians, Chinese, and Koreans had such technologies, and that it was necessary to develop knowledge of this themselves to protect North American citizens, you know, or to use in more aggressive means. The experiments at Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal was a product of this thinking, and Dorothy, I think, is going to talk a little bit more of these, and making the linkages between the LSD prison experiments and what we know was going on at Allen Memorial Institute, where the research was funded by the CIA and involved, you know, mind control, these kinds of experiments. And I've been especially worried, given recent events, that the CIA has been given new scope to go forward with covert action, to go into countries, you know, and assassinate other people. But as well, you know, all the kinds of things that were happening in the Cold War are going to happen again. And there's new fear. You can hear it on the radio about biological and chemical weapons. But what has to be known is the same fear, you know, during World War II, the Cold War, was justified to undertake numerous biological and chemical experiments in the past. And there's a worry that it's going to happen again. And also I want to say that many of the men who came to hold high-ranking positions within the Canadian penitentiary system came from military backgrounds. And this included L.P. Jeanreau, who was chief of penitentiary medical services, whom Dorothy will speak of. Jeanreau, his son, Paul Jeanreau, some of you might know of his work. He's current researcher for Correctional Services Canada, and he's undertaken a lot of the solitary confinement sensory deprivation experiments. The invention and promotion of new drugs and World War II intersected with the new penal philosophy, rehabilitation. Although first recommended in 1938 by the Archambault Commission, the philosophy ushered in the medical model and a greater role for scientific experts. Prisoners were regarded as sick and in need of treatment to be provided by psychiatrists, psychologists, and other specialists. And we saw earlier some of the examples of these so-called treatments which were designed to cure, prevent their criminality. And finally, I want to mention the thalidomide disaster. I'm sure you all know of the birth defects caused by this drug, thalidomide, which was given specifically to expectant mothers. In 1962, the consequences of this drug came to be known, and it was taken off the market. Following, more stringent drug tests were required on all drugs prior to their availability on the market, both in the United States and in Canada. And this meant that they had to find large populations of people to test these drugs out on. So prisoners became a very convenient population in this regard. And in fact, the Canadian penitentiary system was very welcoming to pharmaceutical companies and courted them, their involvement, in fact. The relationship forged between prison system and pharmaceutical companies, I would argue, continues today with the over-medication of prisoners. There are other historical moments which contributed to prison experimentation, but Dorothy will talk in more detail. And I'm sure you're really dying to hear her and not me. You've been very patient, though, listening to me, and I will close so that we can get on to the main event. My main point is, though, that as long as there are prisons, there will be human experimentation of some kind. The shape such experimentation takes will be informed by historical circumstances, the existing political, economic, and social factors. But if we want to end prison experimentation, we must end prisons. Mm-hmm. But we must never forget the experimentation that occurred and may continue to occur, even if we close down prisons, inside psychiatric hospitals, general hospitals, residential schools, group homes, the military, and so on. Wherever there are vulnerable people, bereft of the rights of the ordinary citizen.
Well, for the academics in the room, this is a fine example of an academic partnering up with the subject of study.
Like I'm your subject of study sometimes.
And we encourage that, and we hope that we've started a trend, because so many people in academia study us without getting to know us, and so I'm grateful for that. And this has been a marriage. And it's been great, and I thank you, Kathy Kendall, for taking me on.
You too adopted me.
And I thank the academic community, because the academic community has taken me on and helped me to disseminate a lot of this information. My name is Dorothy Mills Proctor. I was born in Nova Scotia. If Faith Nolan was here, she'd call me a McBlack. And she is. We're Black Indians. There are, I think, three Black Indians in the conference. There's myself, Faith Nolan. She fell on the other side of the blanket. And Danette, if you knew Danette, she's at the where you come in to register.
you know, the heavyset lady with the curly hair and the dark skin, she's a Cree woman. And and I'm Mi'kmaq and Faye is Mi'kmaq, but we are black Indians as a result of the indigenous people in Canada taking in the slaves that came up through the Underground Railroad. So a whole nation was created as a result of that. And we are the same black Indians that reside in Louisiana and the Carolinas. When I was growing up, some people used to say to me, well, what are you today? And I said, well, gee, I think I'm black today. They say, well, what are you today? Well, I think I'm First Nations today. So I had that, you know, fun with that. I also have European blood in me and my mother's side, Scots. And never acknowledged it that much, never, because they were the people that hurt us and da-da-da, you know, and she represented of the white race. And but I went to see Braveheart. Well, when I came out of Braveheart, I was Scots for a year. We were the Highlanders, dear, and that was like, well, all these warrior races are in my blood, and I just love it, so now I'm fine. It's okay. It's okay. I came out of a very, very difficult childhood. My family grew their own victims. Generational incest. moved around a lot. Moved between Canada and the United States. We had relatives who lived in Boston, so I lived in Boston and New York City and all through Canada. I was a chronic runaway at 12 as a result of what was happening in my homes, wherever I was. And it wasn't just one home, it was the man all through the family, uncles, cousins. I grew up thinking that a penis was a teat. Anyhow, so that took me to about 12 years old, and I started to run away at 12 years old. Was I a bad child? No, I was not a bad child. I was an abused child, and I was sad, and I was confused, and I was barely literate, and I was abandoned, and all of those things, but not bad. I started to do bad things for survival, sex trade, it's amazing that I remember some of the Johns, because some of the Johns are now in positions of great authority in this country, and clergy. I don't know what it is about clergy, but they're in there, you know. Anything deviant going on sexually, they're there. And that's not to paint them all like that, because I have friends who are priests, and they tell me, I want you in my life because you keep me honest, because I don't bite my tongue with them. If they were in the room, I'd say the same thing. I promise not to dazzle you with bullshit. That led to me committing crimes. I'm on the street. I'm now a street kid. I'm sort of, you know, hitchhiking all over the place, running into other children like myself, young people like myself. So at the age of 16 years old, four of us committed a robbery. The other three were white, Canadian, and I was the black child who led these good white children astray. And these children had never done anything like this before, but neither had I. We don't know who, I'm not going to try to say who's zooming who, but you know, we're four, two boys and two girls. I was sentenced to 3 years, first offense to a federal penitentiary. The value of the theft was $500, and that $500 was false I was falsely accused of that because that was the price that was put on the car that I was supposed to have stolen. I couldn't drive. I didn't know the car was stolen. These were boys that my friend and I ran into, and we went hanging out with the boys. And I was charged with car theft, so that was a wrongful conviction. But it was the only one they could get me, but they had value, you see, $500. So we throw children away in federal penitentiaries for $500 for 3 years, first thing. And robbery 1960.
What happened to the three?
Well, I'll answer questions after. And remember that question because I like to answer it. So now I'm in P4W, and my I almost don't like to tell this story because I don't want to embarrass the lesbians in the room, but I am now an honorary lesbian, so I'm going to say it. Faith Nolan said I'm an honorary lesbian, so I'm an honorary lesbian. You have to remember, I didn't know anything about the homosexual community. I mean, of course it was around me, but I didn't recognize it. I didn't know it because people were people to me, and it didn't care, right? So, and it was never blatant. I mean, it was never identified for me, so I didn't know. And I entered P4W, and you had to have a bath, shower bath, and the matron. And I'm sorry, I don't call them correction officers. I mean, that is so provocative. What is a correction officer? You know, a matron or a guard. This was a matron. And the matron is to supervise my bath now. Well, I'm a modest little thing. I'm not going to wash my private parts in front of somebody watching me. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm almost frozen in fear because here I am in a penitentiary, you know, da da da. And the process, the whole process was just so awful, you know, going to court, being talked to the way I was talked to. The arresting officer had kicked me and pinched me and slapped me. You know, that whole process was so violent and so abusive. And now, you know, now I'm here and I'm having this bath and someone's watching me. And she says, well, you know, you have to wash your private parts. I said, well, I will if you would turn your head. No, 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 no. And so here, resistance. So she says, oh, well, I shall do it for you. I said, you will not do it for me. And she reached in the tub to touch my private parts with her bare hand. Well, the fight was on. And this was a predatory lesbian woman, and the system is full of sexual predators, whether they're male or female. The system is full of sexual predators. So that was my first encounter with what I was told was a lesbian. But none of my lesbian friends are like that, so this was just a deviant bitch, you know. So the fight was on. Two things you can't say in the system. You can't say no and you can't say why. You can't ask why. You can't say no and you can't ask why. She's an authority. She's the boss. She's also deviant. She writes me up. The slant is for her. I'm the bad person. I go to the hole. Okay? I walked in the door resisting. Nine days after I was in P4W, the drugging started, the forced psychiatric drugging started. And on the document it says for migraine headache. And I never had a migraine in my life. But I was giving them trouble. They had to quieten me down. So they started with a drug called Felazine. And first of all, you do not give Felazine to somebody for a migraine headache. I now know. I didn't know what they were giving me. I didn't know about drugs. I had not taken drugs. I didn't know the names of drugs. And then all through the document, it says medicated, medicated, medicated. So 9 days after I arrived in T4W, they started to drug me. So it was a combination of drugging me and sensory deprivation. And he's thrown me in the hole for 52 days, bread and water. That means every 3 days you get a bowl of porridge and a cup of tea and a boiled potato. You don't come out. I wear glasses today, tinted, because of the sensory deprivation. then electric shock. Because they still couldn't control me. I was still raising hell, you know? I was still saying no. And I was still asking why. So then they started to shock my brain. Didn't take me out. Standing on the shoulders of my ancestors, I'm not going down, you know? And you've got to remember, because now I'm 17, right? I've never heard of any of this stuff before. I don't know what's going on. I have absolutely no knowledge. I have absolutely no knowledge. Of prison politics, of how you survive in prison. I learned, you know, but I didn't know first going in. So now I am being drugged, not just Stelazine, Haldol, Nebutal, Librium, Lithium, Chlorpromazine, which is Thorazine, which is the granddaddy of antipsychotic drugs. Also, I'm being targeted by sexual predators, matrons and inmates. And I was labeled sociopathic, psychopathic, very, very violent. The most violent inmate in the institution at that time. Now, if you were to see my prison files, there's three pieces of piles of paper. You've got a conduct sheet, and you have your punishment sheet. But there's a paper before that, and that paper is the medication, your medical file, right? Nobody ever thought to tie in my acting out, because Haldol creates violence. Monday, I would be given Haldol, saturated with Haldol, morning, noon, and night. Okay? Tuesday, I tear up the joint. See? Wednesday, I'm in the hole 52 days, bread and water. The drug was causing the violence. Mrs. down in the States that killed her five babies. Haldol. She was under psychiatric care, I don't know for how many years. I have a problem with that husband to continue to impregnate that woman after he knew that his wife had a problem after the first child. I do have a problem with that. I don't know where that's coming from, but anyway, I don't know if anyone's ever thought of that. But
absolutely, 7 years pregnant or lactating. Yeah. Full of kids.
Mm-hmm.
No break.
And on Haldol.
Right.
So you see where I'm going with the drugs and the violence, and how drugs can create a lot of things. But what were they doing with me? Why were they doing this with me? Okay. First of all, where I am today is as a result of being drug-free for 15 years. I got drug-free 15 years. My anniversary is October the 5th. I'll be 15 years. And the only thing I can say about that, it was a spiritual exercise. I don't know what happened, but I know the government really hates it that I'm drug-free. Because when I got drug-free, I was clear. I could start to think. I could start to figure out what the hell happened to me. I had lived for 24 years contrary to my own nature. Okay? I didn't come out of the chute saying, oh, wow, when I grow up, I want to be a whore. You know? But when I grow up, I want to be a drug addict. When I grow up, I want to sit here in front of a whole bunch of people and say, hi, everybody, I'm a former offender. You know what I mean? These aren't things that we want to do when we're growing up. I mean, I didn't want to be Barbie doll, but probably wanted to be an astronaut or something, you know, because there's a drive in me. I want excitement. I crave excitement. But there's lots of legitimate ways to do that. There are a lot of healthy ways to do that. And we're not directed in that direction, you see. So,